nice to have the opportunity to sit down with you again. It was a different time for me when we last spoke to have a conversation like this. And so here we are, a pandemic, a few adventures along the way. Now here at the University of East London to have another little exploration together.
Sounds great.
Yeah, well, maybe a fun place to begin, because I know it's something you've spoken about recently at the University of Oxford, and it's a good place to maybe offer a bit of an introduction to yourself, perhaps through the lens of that, through the lens particularly of DMTX, opens the field for what we're going to be discussing today a little bit. We'll take it some other places too. But go on then, who are you in relation to DMTX? What does that mean to you?
Wow. So yeah, DMTX is, from my perspective, a transhumanist technology, or certainly is being rolled out as such. And Andrew Gallimore, if you look at his recent, not so recent, Breaking Convention talks, he's already laying down the protocol, which is to have us in suspended animation, in vats, especially, you know, essentially, where you are having food fed in through a drip or through a tube, waste management taken care of, and you are literally being fed DMT intravenously, infused, so continuous infusion, which is what the extended part of DMTX means.
And what is DMT?
So DMT is a known chemical that sits in the brain, is in almost everything on the planet. It's an extraordinary medicine that seems to launch us into a parallel reality, very much a holographic wonderland. Whether that is a parallel reality or not is up for debate. And I think one of the advantages of DMT Extended is the ability to really test that, to test that theory. I mean, for me personally, I see this language, this light language, hieroglyphic. It's always at the core of my visions. And I can sort of move around these hieroglyphs, and they're sort of ancient and modern at the same time, made of light. And one thing I've always wanted to do in the 6 years of research at Imperial, being a participant on the studies there, is literally draw them, you know, whilst in them, because it needs to be done inside the trip. And unfortunately, the protocols are quite strict and you're not able to really do anything. You're blindfolded for one. And so it's not possible to draw these, even during the DMT Extended study, which was the last phase out of three that I've done there. So yeah, so I'm looking forward to next steps. And one of the big next steps is that there's now a legal license to administer DMTX on an island in the Caribbean. And so that opens up a whole other can of worms, because if we think about all the clinical studies that are happening in the world, they're all generally in hospital wards, very clinical, clues in the on the tin. But yeah, it's a very unpleasant place and context to take any medicine, any psychedelic, and of course you're not going to get very good results. Although you could argue that there have been pretty decent results at the studies at Imperial, etc., but they're limited in terms of the amount of people they can put through those studies. It's very expensive to get the licensing to manufacture the medicines, etc., etc. So all of those studies depend on benefactors. It's not easy for Imperial or any other clinical facility to then get funding. It's not like you can apply for funding generally, like I would, you know, as an academic doing research in Europe through Horizon or Erasmus. So it's a tricky and difficult space to work in. And those people should be absolutely admired. But I think that, you know, it's the funding problem, it's the legality problem. It's great that Imperial have really put, I think that they've been responsible almost, you know, for the psychedelic renaissance. They've done a tremendous amount of work to enable the legalization of a lot of these medicines, because they've shown that they are safe, especially DMTX, because one of the biggest findings from Chris and Lisa, who ran the study of DMTX, the real, I mean, it was actually the Germans that got there first in 2005, but And Rick Strassman and Andrew Gallimore theorized about it before the Imperial study. But the Imperial study shown that it's safe for the heart, at least. The heart stabilizes. There's as you are launched into the DMT realm, your heart rate rises. But as time goes in, it stabilizes. So there's safety protocol, which is the first step. And again, it's pretty short, that duration, but it doesn't feel short when you're in there, I can assure you. I think the DMT Island, I like to call it, which is a bit of a pun, but I think, yeah, this holds potential because we could have a lot more people go through the experience. We could do it in nature effectively, and it's legal.
Right. Yeah, a few things come into me in terms of ways to move a bit of the field of possibility together into somewhere towards the critical, because we are here talking about something that is among the most critical of different experiences you can undergo. We're talking about what it is to transform the landscape of your conscious field dramatically in the context of what that means for humans relating to culture, pre-established patterns of order. Well, we can talk about, for instance, the safety for the heart, but when it comes to reliable return to valuing, as one might have before, the ordinary patterns of culture, we could be talking about something very disruptive. And this is the most basic point to make about, let's say, psychedelics as a cultural or recent cultural phenomenon. And I make it just to open the door to consider the whole realm of what it means to develop protocols, what it means to situate psychedelics, what it means to situate sacrament in the context of ritual, what it means to participate in transformation as a collective process, what that means as a phenomenon for culture broadly, what that means in the context of our culture being devoid for many of us for viable places to enter the kind of ritual you might associate with DMT or other psychedelics, or at least the kind of openness to participation with layers of patterns and meaning which we might imagine to take place in rituals enabling of profound connection and what have you. And so what does it mean to integrate an experience? What does it mean to heal? We can see that through the lens of clinical work in a lab or what have you, but at the end of the day, we're taking someone into a very particular context. Fine. I mean, very much appropriate in some sense. Let's say peak states, peak experience that you might orient a whole year or decade or life around. Well, of course, that's going to be a special time, a kairotic time, right? A special place. But the whole world of, well, what does it mean to engineer, furnish, you know, artistically enable a space to be in support of an experience? Forget, and then to think of the relationality of that in terms of the ritual. We are speaking about something which, as powerful as the internal experience is, it seems only appropriate that we, in that sense, take as seriously the factors of the external world, which are, of course, in relationship with what we're experiencing. And I mention all of this because we could take the conversation in a direction that perhaps it was a little bit of what we were speaking about before, because it's so much on the pulse of discovery, really, when we start thinking about things like the pyramids, and we start thinking about landscapes and temples and constructed contexts which might come into some kind of supportive relationship with the profound inner transformative experiences too. So that's a lot to open, but it seems relevant in the context of what might be most interesting for us to talk about. So I'm curious what sort of comes through from that, sure. If there's anything that grabs you.
Yeah, well, I think I was, as you know, talking to Cadell and his philosophy portal crew for 3 hours yesterday, and one of the things that was basically compared to DMTX was Neuralink. Mm-hmm. You know, and the two being kind of like equal in their potential disruptive factors. Because if you think about DMTX, it represents a form of technology. It represents electricity for the psychedelics, right? So you're plugging in and out of DMT. You can literally curate the trip according to, you know, you may be coming across in the, because you know you can be talking to the participant, right? You can, as the person in control of the dosing, you can increase the dose during the trip. It's not like one hit where you're just going in for the ride. You can actually, and if the participant is, say, coming across an entity in the space, but the resolution's too low, you can increase the dose. In fact, they can say to you, I need you to increase the dose right now because I'm experiencing an entity. And then you actually get the full resolution of the entity. And then after the meeting, you can then say, now you can turn it down a bit. I'm going to have a little rest. But you're still in the journey. So it's this idea of curated trips that can be, from my perspective, from the hyperhuman perspective as opposed to the transhuman perspective. So Andrew Gallimore, who I love to death, but is, for me, much more in the sort of like, let's go down the sort of post-biological era. Let's get rid of our bodies. Let's become the entity. Let's, like, you know, of course we are aliens. You know, we forget that. You know, but we have this very, very rare opportunity, in my opinion, and the jackpot win is to be human. So let's make sure we explore that, because it's 1,000 months. That's the window. That's 83 years. People think they own stuff. People think they own the land. It's completely insane. So people have got it all wrong, but what they haven't got wrong is that we're here to have the human experience. So I think if we are going to go down on these new forms of psychedelics as technology, as electricity, then let's make sure that we go in with very specific problems to solve, like whether it's a scientific problem, whether it's, you know, let's try and work on the climate, let's look at all the different things we can do as artists, but let's bring in the people that really can benefit from the journey. And these things are not for the faint-hearted. This is not recreational. This is very hardcore. And it's, you know, in some ways not even pleasant. It's very much for psychonauts only. And people, I mean, I had a conversation yesterday about, you know, is hyperhumanism only for the few? Only because most people are like Netflixing themselves to death and are quite happy not to question anything and quite happy to just get through life, not even being invested in it, just to get through the days. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the last man, you know, in Nietzsche's Zarathustrian terms. And what I want everyone to be the overman. I want everyone to like have that passion and that investment in life. But you'll never get that. And I don't think that's necessarily even needed. You know, everyone's on their own journey. And some people are at certain parts of the journey. And some people are, it's not even linear. I think it's in a spiral. And I think that we should embrace a bit like music taste. Some people have got, in my opinion, awful music taste. But you still have to respect that. You know, that's just where they are with what they think is good music. So for me, it's like, let's understand that these new opportunities represent it's a new threshold which we're breaking, where we can go in and have a specific scientific problem to solve, and maybe you solve that in a room with lots of people going in at once. So maybe six scientists all working on the same problem, we now have the opportunity for them to all launch at the same time and be in potentially the same space working on the same problem. And I think that's what's super fascinating. And you know, I would disagree with the Neuralink thing. I think the Neuralink, which if the audience don't know what it is, so Elon Musk's brain-computer interface, which is nothing new about the brain-computer interface, but what it represents really is, you know, your mobile phone being inserted into your brain, and then there's no longer a distance between your phone and your brain, and I find that really transhuman, very frightening. And it's a bit like one button solutions for everything. You know, at the moment we've got that button to get me a girlfriend, get me a new job, get me a, you know, get me a life, you know. And I think that's the big problem, that we have this expectation now of convenience, of instant gratification, and there being no distance. We used to write letters, right. You know, we used to write letters and we used to wait for a reply. Mm. And by doing that, we generated the sensation of time, you know. And now we don't have any sensation of time. And I think Cadell's got an amazing guy from the on his show, Time Energy. And his book's all about why we have no time and no energy and the reasons for that. And I think it's to do with technology. It's to do with the instant gratification culture. So for me, Neuralink represents the collapse. And Cadell wrote a great piece on this on the hyperhumanism as, you know, this represents the end of the struggle. And I think the key thing about being human is the struggle. We learn much more from our mistakes and much more from our misfortunes than we do from our pleasures. And that's why heaven, if such a place exists, may be unbearable within a week, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, well said. I think the embrace of the struggle is necessary. I mean, learning itself, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I hear myself about to say that learning can be terrifying. Of course, learning is also wonderful. And so really want to be careful to provide in some sense more of the whole here, because otherwise you sort of sound ridiculous. But what it is to relate to the horizon of your own knowing, let's say, to broach the horizon of what you've so far experienced in your life, or at least have formed a coherent relationship to, as part of that, can be sort of as well honed as part of your identity. It's reliable, it's safe, it's secure, it's ordered. To encounter something otherwise, there are just obviously there are gradations of radicality, but then fundamentally as well, and I say this often, you know, you can drown in a puddle or the ocean, and it's a little bit like that point with respect to music. I mean, you respect both the puddle and the ocean in that regard. There's something dignified about any perception of music as well. Like, it's so interesting to me how multivariate the human experience is, and yet we exist in a soup of culture. We exist in a channel, a field of culture that in some sense must, by virtue of being a culture, have within it the capacity for that disparate, multivariate nature of experience to actually hold together enough for what? So that we don't encounter the kind of difference that immediately descends to a kind of violent rejection. We can't have that perspective. That's too terrifying. We've got to cut that out in all the many ways we can do that. And so that's a little bit, you know, it's interesting. Why am I saying all this stuff? There's partly a thread, like a deep thread I'm experiencing. And we've spoken about this a little bit. It does relate to what it is to sort of build, let's say, the social architecture and the philosophy and an artistic sensibility around the administration of DMT, curating the experience in that regard. There's a lot to take into account there. And part of that taking into account is as well a tremendous ethical dimension. It's a ethical dimension of relating to others as a cultural being in the context of nature. And there's so much to bring in here. But I remember if there's any of this film right now that gets interspersed with any clip, I may or may not do it. But we recorded a conversation which hasn't been released. It was actually online, of course. I was referencing before, 6 years ago, we met in person. We did record something online, I believe, the day before you went into your first DMT-X experience. And so it's quite interesting, or certainly be interesting for me to go back and, you know, look at like the before and after in some sense. But one of the things we did speak about was conscience. And this is something I've never done a whole episode, a public episode about in relation, but I think we have explored it privately. It's certainly very interesting to me. And so it's kind of interesting to ask someone like yourself, who genuinely is, at least in the kind of the intellectual Western culture circles of psychedelia, and you know, it is more globalized than that, you're a genuine psychonaut. And I wonder how much the notion of conscience, in that sense, the significant orientation of one's own being in relation to the context encountered. And I'm very curious about, for instance, because here's something that would be like, let's say, this is a silly thought in a way, but it would be kind of interestingly terrifying, right? And that would be, and maybe it is like it is, and ontology to the side, because it's very relevant here, and we could, what do we mean by entities? We could go into this. I think it would be very interesting just to take that as an angle in. But I can imagine something quite terrifying, for instance, about just about anyone being able to, in that sense, open source access, plug in to ask or find out some pattern about this or that. Of course, this permeates the, let's say, the conspiracy world of interpretation of this type of material. And I'm not trying to like strong arm look down upon that, or what it is in the pattern recognition mind that is seeking to understand and recognize actually the tremendous relationship between governments and psychological manipulation and all the experimentation, right? But that in principle, if we're speaking about something which has the capacity to make available and make present, we talk about a kind of light language, symbolism, pattern, not ordinarily accessible, but maybe in principle profoundly relevant for interacting in the ordinary cultural world, let's say, well, wouldn't it be rather interesting slash a bit terrifying if an entity was just, oh yeah, I'm kind of curious about this, wouldn't you just hand it over? Now that's like a caricature, but I am kind of wondering in that sense about what it is to, is my experiences, for instance, with psychedelics. There's a, my navigation through them is intimately bound to, in some critical sense, the ethical core of my own integrity as a coherence of being. And so I'm curious what the meaning of conscience is for you in these kind of explorations. And that part of that comes through with hyperhumanism very much, really. I mean, it's kind of like an angle on that in some sense.
Yeah. I think, I mean, a lot of my journeys, and I think that's where I refer to psychedelics as teachers, you know, as entheogens, they are the great teachers. And I think that, you know, you have to go in there with an intention, you know, I always ask for protection, you know, it's just a default setting. And I think that, yeah, you will, if you go in there with bad intentions, or you don't have intentions, or you don't have a strong conscience, or you know, you're reckless in your use of them, you're overusing them, you don't respect the medicine. I mean, a great example is David Luke, who I'm sure you know well. David did, I think, sort of 50 doses at 50 milligrams of DMT on the side of the River Ganges in Varanasi, I believe, over a short period of time. And it was eventually, after some encounter that he recounts in his book, Other Worlds, he was blocked. He was censored from the space for 20 years. I don't know how often he tried to go back in, but he had an orange screen placed over the DMT realm. So he was blocked from entering. Wow. So I think that's my answer to the conscience thing. But yeah, I think going back to my own conscience, having been lucky enough to be, you know, gifted a lot of these experiences, even in a clinical setting, I think that, you know, I think that, of course, these things come with huge challenges, because you're being observed, you're being probed, not just by the entities, but also by the people in the room, the researchers. It's probably as hardcore as it gets, getting in an MRI scanner and having your brain scanned whilst being injected with DMT.
Yeah, well, it's like the boundaries of your actual external beyond the skin are kind of being violated. Obviously, you've agreed to do it, as well as having to navigate a transgression and a transformation of boundaries in terms of how you're interacting within. So that is.
So that's kind of that conscience comes through, because then you're, I mean, that particular journey, which was the first time I was injected with DMT in the scanner, the amount of entities that showed up en masse, extremely concerned for me because I was in the scanner. They're like, what's happening? Why are you being scanned? We're the ones that scan you. You know, we're the ones with the scanners. What are you doing in a scanner? They couldn't comprehend it. There was a cognitive dissonance on their side. And there was this sensation of, you know, let's show him let's give him the truth. Let's show him that he's immortal. So they gave me the flash. So I had this like inverted 5-MeO experience. They showed me I'm immortal. They put me in the light, and they added ticker tape somehow around the entire universe of light. And they were like, just so that I would remember, added ticker tape. I remember it very well. So, and they're like, and then they were like, you're in a human experience right now. It's all telepathic. What's happening? Why are you dying? Can we do anything? You're not scheduled, you know, you're not scheduled. So, and the amount of entities, the variety and the benevolence was absolutely obvious, and it very much made me, you know, that whole, you know, this theory that we have that these are your guardians, that they take you across at death. We know DMT is released. We also know there's not nearly enough DMT in the pineal gland or whatever the myth is. You know, a great paper by Nichols in 2015 at Breaking Convention where he dismantled all the myths about DMT. But maybe there was enough DMT in the pineal gland in the past. Maybe we've atrophied the amount of DMT in our pineal glands because of all the electric lights that we're exposed to. You look at the Koji tribe in Colombia. They are put, I mean, their shaman are chosen at birth, and they were put in the caves for either 9 or 18 years. They're kept in the dark, and their endogenous levels of DMT are through the roof. So what's fascinating is that DMT seems to be like a place where you experience the light. Whether it's 5-MeO DMT, you become the light, and NN-DMT, in all its sources, you see light beings, you know, you see light objects, everything's emanating light. And this dimension, we're seeing light shine upon us from the sun. So it's like we're seemingly experiencing light in different dimensions. I hate the term, but excuse the metaphor, but you know, it seems like there's the top of the pyramid is pure light, you as light, you know, and then all the way down, you're having this different relation with light. And maybe there's sub-levels where you go into the dark. But what's fascinating is that it seems that we incubate DMT and we manufacture it in the dark, but it's all about the light.
Yeah, give me a second with that one. So the first thing that comes to mind is dreams.
Great point.
Because here we are, eyes closed, it's nighttime, and the world is vivid. It's vivid, and it's certainly significant. It's very interesting, you know, how much we are magnetized by the spell of our own projections in life. We can think about it in terms of archetypes. Someone who fulfills enough of that representation of the image, that which inside us, in some sense, its prism of perception is tailored more or less to that which is representative of that image as prism. And there we are, you know, transfixed, something of high salience, high meaningfulness, all this ripeness for its potential relations with ourselves as an unfolding, whole-making totality. It's like woman, sexuality, wife, children, transcendence, marriage, you know, break apart death, how that relates then to the community, how that relates to the broader social order. This character with the funny hat on, a trickster type guy, watch out for him, but kind of interesting too. Hey, don't just like totally push him to the side, get a little bit closer. Oh, maybe you feel a little bit of what it's like to be that yourself. Hang on, look in the mirror, what role am I playing here? All of a sudden, the costumed world, right, that we've been, we kind of magnetize into creation in some critical sense, we're playing a role in the projection of that. So that's something that comes to mind when I think about, if you're talking about, you know, 5-MeO-DMT as light, and then NN-DMT as a kind of an engagement with that which is lit up. I am curious in the context of relating, let's say, with entities. I'm curious about how to make sense of that from different perspectives. One thing that is interesting to me about that, and in the experiences I've had, let's say, navigating encounters, feels totally appropriate for me to use the word encounter, but whether or not by entity I mean the same thing has often been in question. But certainly, as an encounter with the significance of experience, as portrayed in something which, in fact, if I was good with my hands to draw, I might in fact be able to draw some version of. I've had plenty of relationships, let's say, with navigating the significance of the meaning associated with a projected image, and also plenty of experiences where it seems as though there's a deep voice, a kind of, let's say, a resonant pattern, a resonant meaning, as a kind of hum of response, call it a voice of response, that is in some sense kind of like a sound that births in experience in relation to a question or an intention I have. And now all of a sudden, I mean, in that context, there's something quite grounding about that. And this is one of the reasons why conversation and so much of this work links very deeply in, like, why be interested? This thing, what are the connections here? It's partly for me, it's even in, it seems to be the case of the most profound DMT experiences, and perhaps you can shed more light on this. I guess pun not intended, but is that we're in participation. And that's why bringing in the conscience, right? We're in participation in some sense. Let's not forget that. Let's not forget that we're in participation. And therefore, what we seek, how we like conduct ourselves, what it is, our whole culture of treatment of each other, the whole communicational field associated with how we are collectively integrating what it is to relate to the DMT world, what it is to relate to the world of psychedelia. Yeah. Let it not be this mythical, magical thing that just because a few people more or less experience it, like, you can go find some mushrooms, right? So plenty of people are experiencing these things, like, forever, right? But, like, there's not something, it's all of a sudden not so different. It's not so different from what it is to be here and now. You're a magical creature. Do you know what I mean? It's wild. I can encounter you in the flesh. You can share things. You can open up possibilities for me. This adventure, this knowledge, yeah, right? Here you are as a teacher, you know, opening the mind of students and all the possibility. Like, we live in some sense, we live in that magical world. Totally. We live in that magical world. And one of the things I'm certainly like here for in the context of the psychedelic renaissance, which I've never felt tremendously a part of, although certainly curious. I care about the world of academia and the world of research, and all of that's very important. And I also recognize, in some sense, the world of psychedelics, which exists far from any institution. I'm not talking about indigenous contexts. I'm talking about people who are doing their best on this YouTube channel full of that many millions of subscribers and with their mates just trying to relate to something that's trippy and wild. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people right now tripping and all manner of like cultivating relationship with this type of thing. And it's like, let's bring, I'm not saying bring all that together. What I am saying is like, there's somewhere in, I want to say the alchemical soup is too, a little bit too mystical, but there's somewhere in the, there's somewhere in the accessible mundane that we can actually cultivate something wholly not mundane at all in our processes of how we interact and communicate and learn and understand together. And it's some way on navigating those boundaries, right? What it is to speak about something as, on the one hand, with all this potential for sacredness that these profound experiences offer, but also in some critical sense, this is like the realm of like the mystery and the unveiling of mystery. Mm. What is it to treat that with integrity? And what it is to treat that, and just the final thing I'll say, treat that in such a way where it's not just the kind of like the inculcation of an undeserving elite who sort of pull the ladders into that shared epistemic field of communication and relationship. They pull the ladders up after they enter them, right? And they figure out, and we make the rules, here are the understandings, here's what's going on, and now we sort of decree these are the places, this is the right context in which you can do this and that. I'm really committed to, in the context of this transitional world where so much has broken down at the level of religion and how we transmit knowledge and bring up generations, rites of passage, all this stuff, in the dearth and the deficit of all of this, the slowness and care and the consistent challenging of boundaries, both on the horizon of the exploration, as well as actually relating in some sense to the skin in the game here and now of the ordinary mundane, which is not so ordinary or mundane when you're engaged in this process. And there's something in this, like the trans membrane of it all, this life death soup of actually understanding how to move in integrity with all of this. Cause I'm just seeing claims for hidden knowledge up here, and they do very well on YouTube, past life stories of this and that. Well, these are genuine realms of exploration with serious horizons of understanding to uncover, but the architecture of human psychology and social process they leverage and have capacity to orient in this time of this attentional digital world is so tremendous. So I just bring in some of this because of its significance, and I know it's formed a lot of the conversation we've had today and at various times. So thank you for listening to that. Mm. But
yeah, I mean, I'll pick up a few things, but the first thing you mentioned was dreaming. And I think what I'm realizing is that there's a golden thread of dreaming. Like we talked about being in the Great Pyramid and being very privileged to be able to hire the Great Pyramid for the last 3 years. And this year we, just by chance, a friend brought in a EEG headset and we measured our brainwaves, a few of us measured. And we looked like we're all asleep. Mm. Right? Looks like the pyramid, the sacred site, maybe more sacred sites, put you into a state of dreaming. We know that DMT, from Chris's work, scanning our brains in the Imperial, that it looks like you're dreaming. Maybe, I mean, I'm yet to really look into the science, but I know from people drowning, they are going into some liminal state which looks a bit like dreaming. Maybe being underwater in a hyperbaric chamber. I don't know that one either, but I'm guessing that all these things, they seem to have the signature of dreaming. So maybe, and we also know that from neuroscience that the brain is super active whilst asleep. Obviously different parts of the brain are working, but you're asleep, right? You're supposedly unconscious. So maybe death isn't an absence of consciousness, but it's actually maybe super consciousness.
Yeah, I sense there's some more there for you to expand on. Could you share some of your own history of relating ever closer, it seems, to the phenomenology of death?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a massive explorer of death, and I think that, I think that it's the great taboo, isn't it? It's one of these things where we need to really run headlong into our fears, and I think that I've really overcome it. I mean, one of my first real sensations of there's something way bigger than this reality, or maybe a hyper reality, was an out-of-body experience that I had at 27 when I was in Brighton. It was 1999, it was New Year's Eve, and everyone was running around headless chickens thinking that the Y2 bug was going to destroy all the computers. And so it got, but this was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was absolutely sober as a judge. It was 2 o'clock in the, it's basically daytime, and I was in my friend's house, walked into an empty lounge upstairs in Brighton and went out of body. And I remember the sensation, I'm standing up, I went out of body, suddenly I'm a ginormous beam of light. And I'm like, oh my God, what's happened? You know, have I died? But I could still sort of feel the sensation of standing up. And then I'm in this wheel of light and I'm rotating, a ginormous energy sensation. I am a ginormous piece of energy and I'm a ginormous piece of light, and I'm moving in this sensation of like rotation. And then I can sense these other spokes of light, and I'm suddenly in a wheel of light with these 8 other spokes of light. And then suddenly this voice just goes, you're not Carl. You're having the experience of being Carl, but your soul is inhabiting 8 other bodies, and you're experiencing these other lives in parallel, but you're only aware of one. And then the voice was also, look up, because you're also in this larger body of light. Before I could do that, my friend's calling me down from downstairs, calling my name. And as I'm being called, it's like I'm being poured back into my body. Imagine like liquid consciousness being poured back in. And as I'm being poured back into my body, the voice is obviously aware that I'm not going to be around in that space for long. So it's like 2 more things. There is no death, and tell everybody. Mm. And it was the tell everybody that was the real invitation or the ticket. And I'm still standing up. No time had passed, but I'd suddenly gone into this incredibly real, much more real than this reality it felt, and absolutely no clue as to what caused it. I hadn't done any DMT at that point. I was like 27. It was my 27th year, which is a special number. And 10 years it took me to find DMT after that. And DMT was nothing like it, completely nothing like it. So even now, I don't know what it was. I remember reading, coming across a book not that long ago. It's called the Book of Knowledge, or the Keys of Enoch. It's quite a wacky book, but in that book, it's got this 9-spoked ring or wheel of light, and it's called the Programming Station of Or, O-R. And I'm like, was that it? Was I in that place, in that space? And I think that gave me my first real sensation, my first proper out of body without substances, and that was important. And it made me sense that there, you know, I'm more than this body. I'm more than this avatar, or whatever you want to call it, and there is something much greater out there, whether there is out there or whether it's in. But yeah, that really gave me the first kind of glimpse. And then at 40, I had a full-on life review. Again, another near-death experience. I don't think that was a near-death experience, but it was a gift. But at 40, I had this experience where my life stopped. And then I was experiencing life in reverse. And life reviews are very common in terms of their phenomenology. So a lot of people report having life reviews at death or near death. And this was extraordinary because it was like absolutely episodic chunks of memory, completely IMAX recorded, like every stain on the carpet was still present. And I went back entirely 40 years in an hour. So an hour in our time, but I went back in time 40 years in real time, which what felt like real time. And not only did I have this double consciousness, this is where double consciousness was born. I was in my current consciousness as I am now talking to you. And then I was in my consciousness going backwards. And then because I'd had the out of body experience at 27, I was like, oh, I wonder if I can leave my body and go into the scene. So the first thing I did was try and go into a table, and I became wood consciousness. So triple consciousness, wood consciousness, my consciousness now, and my consciousness back then. And incredibly, I went back 2 years, and I'd gone back into a relationship with a girl from Berlin. She had unfortunately got pregnant through an accident. She was a week pregnant. She phones me up. I'm in London, she's in Berlin. She says, I'm having an abortion, abortion's on Tuesday. So I rush over to Berlin, and I'm like, bloody hell, I can go into her body. So I went into her body, experienced what it was like to be pregnant in the life review, this is. And I felt her doubt about giving up the baby. And she'd never expressed it in reality. She'd never expressed it. And then I was like, oh my God, I can go into the fetus. So I went into the fetus and I experienced the abortion at a cellular level in a quadruple consciousness, in a complete paralleling of consciousness. And that's what made me think, oh my God. So in the death state...
While one of you is holding down wood consciousness...
No, that was a separate part. That would have been a fifth thing, but no, I wasn't holding down the wood consciousness. I was in her body experiencing pregnancy for the first time and experiencing this cellular... And I felt as if, yeah, she was only so recently pregnant she could take a pill for the abortion to happen. But it was like... no consciousness in the cells at that point, I believe. I think that's a known thing, that it's the 49th day of conception that the soul enters the body. I totally believe that. But my point being is that I think in death, we have life as product. So you're driving a point of view in life, and in death, you have field of view, which means I can become you in death, because we're sitting here now talking, and I can have all of your memories and all of your life experience, just because we're meeting now. And maybe you only might need to meet for a day in order for me to access your entire life up until that point. So it's like, be careful who you spend your time with and be careful where you go, because in the death state, there's no time. You can explore ad infinitum, anything you've ever experienced. So now I treat my life as a point of view. I'm driving a point of view to access the field of view in death. So I'm investing a lot in death, you could say.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So a question that's coming to mind is to do with how you've noticed yourself, or how you would share your story now. In some sense it's a question, in a sense, like, who are you and what are you doing? But influenced by my perception that across these experiences, or in these experiences, as well as others, I think people can relate to this in their own way. It's an instance of universal psychological experience. You could talk about it in terms of individuation, or we could just think more basically about different parts or aspects of ourselves coming into relation with each other, and gradually we can become aware of more of our nature. We can, in some critical sense, come online to who we are as we navigate new life situations, take on new responsibilities, in that sense, translate our learning into the kind of contribution which participates in this foundational, so far ongoing journey of life reproducing life, of is experiencing what all of this is. And I'm kind of curious, one of the things about, you know, psychonautics, and we can just think about mysticism here, we can think about really openness to experience at even just a psychological level. With such an array of experiences, and this is like canonically, I mean, by the sounds of it, you're expressing the capacity to sense and experience the context of a person's experience in ways that are totally radically different. In some, I mean, I often say that, you know, I remember you said this to me once in your articulation of non-duality, you said, I am both of us and so are you, is what you said to me. And there's something about that which I resonate with. And then there's this other aspect, and I've written on this, in some critical sense, certainly in this duration, I'm captaining my influence here, as you are yours. There is choice, there is real orientation of how we participate in relationship. And there's an excitement in that. You know, I don't know exactly what you're going to do. We might develop a trust, and there's a resonance and what have you. And so it's a very radical thing to really suggest that the totality of another's, in that sense, the prism of perception and the context of experience, for that to be known, in some sense, when we resonate with music and what have you, I can, you know, we have words like empathy and taking a second person perspective and all of this stuff. I have a lot of obviously a lot of care about, and it all seems quite straightforward at one level. But one wonders about just how much of a richness there is in terms of where we meet in that imminence of the life-death ecology of second person. I think about those things as like a cluster together. In fact, in Cadell's book, or the Abyssal Arrows book, is partly what I've written in there, is about some of this. Again, Cadell Last, the philosophy portal. The reason I'm saying this, the initial question to bring it back, is how have you found yourself to be cultivating specifically, and it's unknowable in some important sense, but specifically the cult, you know, in and amongst all of this, if death is in some important sense and like a radical expansion, well, life then is a time for a certain like radical singularity in relation to what is beyond it. So there's some things here we could talk more, but I'm curious about like what has been like, who are you in relation to all of that? What has cultivated in you? What is, you know, how do you make sense of the story of your life? There's something that has to be strong in there for it to hold together.
Mm.
It's not necessarily ordinary. I mean, we're talking in some sense about the qualitative experience, the phenomenology of madness.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what is it? What is it that is a, what is the place of return for you?
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic question. I think, I mean, a lot of people, when they listen to my talks or they look at me and they judge me and they, you know, they do say you're gone, you're far gone, you know, and that's in the negative sense. And I think I kind of feel sorry for them in that sense, that they think that this is gone.
Mm.
You know, I think this is actually, you know, it's really important to explore your consciousness as far and wide as possible. And I think what we want is the range, the dynamic range, to be as wide as possible. So from the lowest lows to the highest highs. And that in that gap is your human character, you know, is what you draw upon. And of course I've reached levels of, I wouldn't say madness, I feel like I'm always quite consistent. You know, when we meet, you know, I don't have these extremes of borderline personality or like, you know, bipolar or anything like that. I feel like I'm always very kind of stable, no matter what. No, I mean, I was on the train looking at reading Hegel on the tube, like, and actually writing my talk for Cadell, and like my girlfriend's, how do you do it? You know, it's like you're in the middle of a storm on a boat, and yet you're still able to concentrate on something quite abstract. So I think in that sense, I've enabled my essence to be able to accept anything coming in, and I used to call it positive indifference, which is why I call it positive, because most people associate indifference with a negative thing. But I think that, you know, no matter whether life gives you some shitty day or whether it's some amazing thing that happens, it's 1,000 months that you're here, and it doesn't, your successes are actually less useful than your failures. And that's why it's all quite even. And it's, you know, I was unemployed for 7 months before I got this job, and being a white middle-aged man, it's probably the worst time to be that.
Yeah.
And you know, every job, yeah, I went for, even though I was probably the most qualified person, I wasn't, you know, I was that demographic. So it was like very traumatizing, but it was super humbling to not know where my next pay packet was coming from, and to not have any sort of like buffer, and to go into the gig economy, and just to do, you know, very, you know, to get very, you know, to just be back in the uninstitutionalized world. Because I've been an academic for 25 years, and it's true, you become institutionalized. And, you know, we talk about mental institutions as, you know, it's not that different, you know, being in a, you know, it's a form of madhouse being an academic. So, especially today in this modern world.
It's the most terrifying place I've ever personally had LSD. inside a university, like inside a university building.
Yeah. But you can see the pressures on academics today. No matter where you are in the world, it's like the student is now the customer, and it's the dynamic there that's all it's completely different to how it necessarily should be, I think. And I feel you know that's symptomatic of a lot of our institutions and a lot of how we now have to operate. It's, you know, it's a business context. It's not how it should be.
Yeah, well, a lot of the conversation and field of inquiry, let's say, in relation to voicecraft over the last years, a core part of it recently has been in relation to economics, political economy, thinking about things like the market in relation to the state, in relation to the commons. And you definitely strike me as someone who is a researcher very much with the primary interest of the commons at heart. I mean, that is kind of typified in the expression you shared from your 27-year-old one, you know, tell everyone.
Mm.
Yeah, and, you know, in some sense, that's part of the spirit of interactions and why I record any of this at all for me. And I was kind of reflecting before on the way I said, you know, taking LSD and happened to be spent some time in an academic building a number of years ago. Why even mentioning that is obviously marks me out as someone who's currently not from academia, let's say. And there's all these perceptions still people can have around that. It might not be that helpful to me. And I'm not doing it for any sort of, there's no it wasn't a particularly cool experience. Yeah, there's no like coolness. It's not, I'm mentioning it because, and not because I also think these things should be flippantly normalized either. Like it's not coming from that spirit that just wants to flippantly. The reason I say it is because there's something of how we treat the commons of shared understanding, the commons of our shared humanity, our shared like spirit, really, the commons of how we treat each other and the world. We've really lost touch with that. We've lost. It's not part of the ritual of our lives. The guidance, the possibility for interaction, to gather in shared, common appreciation and desire to presence and remember our values and what matters to us. Again, the big gap left by religion. And we could speak on that more. But in the context then of mentioning things like psychedelics in what might appear a flippant way, you know, I'm asking for that to be heard from the perspective of, again, let's not treat this in a sort of radically foolhardy, democratizing, well, going back to the conversation with Jamie Wheel a few ones ago, just the democratization of transcendence alone, just here we are, yeah, just whatever you want type thing. And then on the other hand, from my perspective, unearned, unjustified desires that some might have to sit atop of the mountain, so to speak, and then choose exactly how such things ought to be ingested and related to in our time. And so there's two walls there I'm trying to press against. There's something of a cultural process and a care for a cultural process. I'm not saying I have the answers, but there's something of our coming to appreciate what it means to relate with these types of experiences, this sort of possibility in our time, which, yeah, I feel like we are this continual blurring of the private and the public, just to open up some space there, you know, and just to take, let's just take a bit of the pressure off, eh? Let's take the bit of the pressure off. Let's be able to say some words and both try and hold to an integrity of understanding. And let's say some words without like having to be so tightened at the neck about what we can say and what we can't say. None of this will help the environment for real seeking and response and understanding at the level of what it means to integrate any of this, full stop. And to continue the sentence would be to say, in the context of culture, in the context of how we're really relating and speaking with each other. And I certainly experience from you someone who's like, you know, you're here to listen, you're here to express, in that sense, the experience we're having now. In fact, the orientation for me is very similar to what it would be to enter into a trip. If I wasn't bringing this orientation, kind of here I am ready to meet what comes along, when there are stakes, then like, whoa, be careful what you're on a journey here, right? There's an adventure that you need to bring yourself to. There's a final question I can ask you as we begin to look towards the close of this, and it would be fun to go for another few hours because there's so much here, but I'm curious what's on the horizon for you. Just leave it at that. What's on the horizon for you?
Yeah, well, there's a few things. I mean, I'm very much trying to formulate and to generate an institute for hyperhumanism. And I've got a bunch of collaborators around the world in Mexico, Berlin, especially in London. And that for me seems very urgent because I think that we now witness, you know, Elon now having put some Neuralink in someone's brain. And again, you know, I think there's nothing special about that in the sense that we know that brain-computer interfaces are not new. But what is new is his attempt to, you know, he says that we have to do this in order to keep up with the AI. So I think that my point with hyperhumanism is very much around this idea that, you know, we're not even human yet. You know, would the post-humanists say that we're done? The human project's finished. Transhumanists, we're going to merge with the machines. It's inevitable. The meta-humanists talk about we must talk to the other kingdoms. We must understand what we are through understanding the languages of other species. And that's happening. Ironically, because of machine learning and AI, we're unlocking these languages and we will soon be able to have converse, probably with dolphins first. And we're not going to like what we hear, obviously. What they have to say about us is not going to be pleasant, but we need to hear it. Because humanism got it wrong in the first place. They put us as the apex creature, saying that we're the most important, the most intelligent. But I think that it's clear that we are now causing the sixth mass extinction. And the mycelium that are under all of our feet have survived five mass extinctions. And they have an operating system. When they're in abundance, they immediately share. So if we could see that, and soon enough we will be able to see the Wood Wide Web with various technologies like, you know, the Vision Pro, etc. The ability to see that intelligence at work, and you look at the work of Merlin Sheldrake and Marshmallow Laser Feast, they're bringing this Wood Wide Web to life, where we can see that intelligence, and we can see that that's probably the biggest psychedelic trip ever, just to observe that, and to then think, well, maybe we're on the wrong path with our individual as cult, individual as cul-de-sac, as dead end.
I like that.
You know, and it's like, how do we really become human? Because I think the humanists got it wrong. And I think that hyperhumanism is very much around, let's not get rid of technology, we can't. I think that it's not about a Luddite approach. It is an approach to the umvelts of others, to the communication with the other kingdoms, to communing with the other, and whether it's the sentient other that's internal to us through these journeys in the psychedelic realms, or whether it's the extraterrestrials. And ironically, one of the funders for DMT Island, as I call it, will be SETI, because SETI have received, I believe, a $200 million donation, and they'll be happy to help us try and find the sentient other through DMT. So there's an extraordinary opportunity there, and I think that that's something that's fascinating. So I think stress testing hyperhumanism, you know, people are desperate for a counter to transhumanism because everyone thinks it's inevitable. I think my main thesis with hyperhumanism is that we've got 50 senses, not five, So how many of us are using those senses? How do we find them? How do we like work with them? And a lot of it's to do with the technology that we've used. They've atrophied not just our imagination and you know, our will. They've atrophied our senses. And even if we think about our sense of location and where we are in space, you know, the Aborigines talk of not hello, how are you? They say, where are you coming from and where are you going? So location in space. The Chinese invented the compass. They didn't invent it for direction. They invented it for placing their cities in locations and then the buildings within those cities at specific angles and the feng shui thing. And then 1,000 years later, they thought, oh, this would be useful for direction. So it's that sort of thing. It's about understanding that we have all these incredible abilities that we have not unlocked. And that technology maybe give us a scaffold to unlock that ability, but then we have a responsibility to build on that and do the work ourselves. And there's a brilliant clip, Huberman clip, where he talks about there's a part of the brain, I can't pronounce it, but it only gets bigger, only develops if you do the things you don't want to do. If you start getting in an ice bath, you really don't want to do it. Almost inevitably, you won't want to do it. I know somebody that's doing it every day and has done it for a year. They still don't want to do it. And that's good. That's exactly what you want to do as a hyperhuman. If you start enjoying it, that doesn't work. The brain stops growing. So you have to not enjoy. It has to be a struggle. Mm. It comes back to that idea that the transhumanist approach is to eliminate the struggle. David Pearce calls it paradise engineering. Another transhumanist. I mean, David's great. He's a third generation vegan. He wants to eliminate suffering. He's looking at it from the animal perspective and eating animals. But I don't think it works for humans. I think we need the suffering. We learn much more through pain. And that's why our capacity for pain is much greater than our capacity for pleasure. We learn way more from our failures. And that's why we should talk about them more. Mm. We should talk about what went wrong. We shouldn't have that culture that we need to be the best versions of ourselves on social media. I'd love a version of social media that's a bit like Dismal Land. You know, I don't know if you saw the Banksy. He did a whole installation, and the people running that installation went to school to learn to be as miserable as hell when they were serving the people coming to Dismal Land. So instead of Disneyland, you've got Dismal Land, which is the worst holiday venue in the world. You know, so it's like that. It's like, yeah. There you go.
Well spoken to, and it's it tied together some pieces that I feel we're really there to bring in. It takes us to the edge of the possibility for understanding field effects, memory, these different senses you mentioned, what it is to perceive our place in things, particularly as it's shifting.
So a couple of other things. So the second, so that's one big project. The other big project is what I call holotechnica. So holo means to combine into the whole, from the Greek, and technica also from the Greek, technique. So how can we combine techniques into stacks, much like what Jamie Will's talking about, to create altered traits? So not just altered states where we're just constantly chasing the next peak experience. How do we create lasting change, normally through a stack, that you can say has led to real breakthroughs, not just like gimmicks, which is what I see a lot in the psychedelic space. It's like when we first did that download, there's a 3-hour talk that I'll send you the link to it, with Rick Strassman, Andrew Gallimore, Graham Hancock, and 4 of us from Imperial. And I brought this panel together so that we could, for the first time, talk about what happened to us in the DMT extended state. It took 2 years for us to be allowed to be talking about it until Imperial published. We were on a blackout. And what's incredible in that video is that we're all talking about these new abilities that we were gifted. You know, whether it's precognition, whether it's telepathy, you know, massive synchronicities. You know, whether it was just mind-blowing to see in such a short period of time, because you're in that realm, you're suddenly given this training and these new abilities. So that's what I'm talking about with Holotechnica. Maybe DMT Extended will be one of these things that you put in a stack, but the stack means, and one of the things I'm doing with New Nautics on this DMT Extended project in the Caribbean is the context engineering. How do we get the perfect context, the pre-context and the post-context? So one of the things that was lacking in the Imperial study was no aftercare, none, right. Really. And then, you really need to integrate that stuff. And in fact, there was a 3-week gap between each of the dosing sessions. And one point I was phoned up and was like, can you come earlier? Can you come after 2 weeks? I was like, no, I need the 3 weeks minimum to integrate. Partly because the entities were getting annoyed. They're like, what are you doing here again? You know, not again. They would still do the work on you, the psychic surgery, but they didn't really wanna. Mm. You know, it's like, you're taking the piss, mate. Mm. So it's really about that. It's like, how do we get these pre-contexts perfectly created? So you're in your parasympathetic. You know, you've collapsed into your parasympathetic nervous system. And one of the best examples of that I've seen recently is my friends that are doing Lomi Lomi massage. You know, traditional Hawaiian massage, but with 5 people massaging you at the same time. Mm. So 10 hands, at some points, they can go underneath your body and they raise you up. You're literally like levitating. And it feels like you're on 5-MeO-DMT just through massage. So your parasympathetic nervous system is perfect. And one of the things that Chris did, I remember in the Imperial study, was do a body scan. So you're scanning your body, you know, the typical thing where you relax every part of your body. It's genius. It's a great way of going into the DMT extended state. But even better, do the body scan after a Lomi Lomi massage, you know.
Right.
And I think that that's crucial in the stack. If you're going to get the best results, have the best outcomes, have the best entity encounters, have the best creative problem solving done, then you need a stack. And then maybe you'll have that training done, and maybe you'll have that new form of telepathy that will allow you to communicate with the animals or whatever it is that's really your gift.
Yeah, wild. Well, you're making it very difficult to close it up because there's these things are just opening, right? I mean, it's interesting, we already communicate with animals, of course, don't we?
Of course, yeah.
And so even in light of this, I guess I find myself insisting and sort of offering this from my own experience to those who might be listening who truly might have had very limited access to these experiences. And it seems as though, it seems from listening to it, it's as if the whole world of possibility that seems to be so meaningful, I feel devoid of it.
Mm.
And I feel like that sometimes like it cultivates this sense of, I need to go and do this thing, and I get that. Like there are real horizons, eh? There are real horizons, but there's also something about the very quality and value and magic of what it is for us to be communicating right now, and for those who are listening, that in some sense there's a depth already here and now, just as present. That for me at least has always been so critically in continuity with all the experiences I've had. And it's on that basis that I meet those experiences, and it's on that basis that I meet you. And so in that sense, to those who are listening, in many respects, you're both, in my opinion, you're both, if we're talking about things which are doing healing, right? Healing and expansion. You are coming home to yourself at the end of the day. Mm. You're coming home to a context of family, of culture. Maybe it's in tatters here or there and it's disconnected, right? But there is something we already have the capacity to show up and be in relationship with in terms of that movement of whole making, that holotechnica. Mm. We're already involved as an organism of tending to what among us is in pain, what among us is in that sense primed for a next step of connection, a next movement of understanding, a next vista of expansion to walk into arm in arm together, or to encounter some difference there and have an adventure with that. I'm just trying to offer some words at the end, and I appreciate everything you're saying. It's super interesting, and I'm looking forward to continuing this even still for these next 10, 15 minutes as we leave this university. But thank you very much for this conversation here.
Yeah, thank you. And my final word, I suppose, would be the mundane is where it's at. You know? And I think that's what it teaches you, that we are literally so gifted to be in this human form. And, you know, your dreams are where it's at. And if you can cultivate your dreams, and I was talking to my students this morning about this new device, this Halo device that will apparently induce lucid dreams. And I'm like, well, that's transhumanist technology, because what it represents is an outsourcing of your own ability to do it, you know? And maybe that technology could be used in a way to give you that first lucid dream, and then you put the technology away and then you practice how to do it yourself. But from my hunch is that it will take away your ability to do it yourself. And we know you can lucid dream. We know it's a possible training thing. It takes a long time to do it, but it's something that's doable. But when you get technologies that will take that ability away from you to learn how to do it yourself, almost inevitably that's a muscle that's gone. The muscle won't be a human muscle, it'll be a technological muscle. And I think that's exactly what I'm trying to talk about, is like the dream and dreaming seems to be that golden thread through the psychedelic experience, through the sacred sites, through the dying, you know, they're all related. And I think that's why they're so magical. And the best way to dream seems to be incredibly sober during your waking life. I notice when I smoke weed or when I like take a lot of drugs, dreaming's gone, because you're dreaming whilst awake then. You're doing your dreaming whilst you're psychedelically involved. So in some ways it's very, very important to have a lot of sobriety and to not be taken up with the romanticism of these journeys, because they come at a cost.
Right.
Always.
Right. Yeah, well, Peter Kingsley argues that the foundation of Western mysticism is actually incubation as the, you know, the context engineering for dreaming, in fact, actually entering the dream, incubation. And so maybe on that note, thank you.
Thank you.